I'm Harry Allen. This is Nonfiction. What is time? What is space? What is reality? Today, we'll talk to a scientist who is attempting to answer these very questions by looking at the universe beyond our senses. It's all on this edition of Nonfiction. Space and time form the very fabric of the cosmos, yet they remain among the most mysterious of concepts. Is space an entity? Why does time have a direction? Could the universe exist without space and time? Can we travel to the past? In his new book, The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality, Brian Greene uses these questions to guide us toward modern science's new and deeper understanding of the universe. From Newton's unchanging realm, in which space and time are absolute, to Einstein's fluid conception of space-time, to quantum mechanics, green reveals our world to be very different from what common experience leads us to believe. Sparked by the trademark wit, humor, and brilliant use of analogy that have made The Elegant Universe a modern classic, Brian Greene takes us all, regardless of our scientific backgrounds, on an irresistible and revelatory journey to the new layers of reality that modern physics has discovered lying just beneath the surface of our everyday world. Brian Greene received his undergraduate degree from Harvard University and his doctorate from Oxford University, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. In 1996, he joined Columbia University, where he is professor of physics and mathematics. He has lectured at both a general and a technical level in more than 25 countries and is widely regarded for a number of groundbreaking discoveries in superstring theory. He lives in Andes, New York, and New York City. We're very honored to have him here as our guest at Nonfiction and at WBAI. Dr. Greene, welcome to Nonfiction and WBAI.
Thank you very much.
What is this book about?
This book is about our changing understanding of what space and time are, going all the way back to Newton's everyday conceptions, the ones that really make good intuitive sense, to the really startling revelations that began with Einstein's insights into space and time and quantum mechanics' insights into space and time. And I try to bring the reader all the way up to the modern developments in what we call superstring theory or string theory, where the ideas of space and time go through another major change.
Why did you write this book?
Well, I have found that there are so many people out there in the general world, in the general community, who get so fired up about the ideas of space and time. They just love to understand how the universe is put together, and they love to learn that the intuitive ideas of space and time as we experience them are actually not real. They're not what science has come to. There's so many people that love to learn these things, but the problem is the modern research is phrased in the language of mathematics. Most people don't speak mathematics. So the point of a book like this is to take away all of the technical details of the math and just use stories and analogies, metaphors to bring forward these wonderful ideas in a way that anybody who's interested can understand.
And I can say to your credit, I was a huge fan of your book, The Elegant Universe, the full title of which is The Elegant Universe, Superstrings, Hidden Dimensions, and the Quest for the Ultimate Theory. And that was published by W.W. Norton. And what I found so engaging about your writing and what made me so excited when I saw you had a new book out is the way that you attempt to convey what I'm sure are incredibly arcane, kind of complicated ideas, mathematically speaking, in common language. And our listeners here at Nonfiction know that I always commend scholars who write for a general lay readership, who try and make complicated ideas simple. So to your credit, you've done that very well, and we are the better for it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. You know, my hope in using metaphors and stories is to not water down the science, but to sort of capture the core of the idea, but in a way that doesn't require the technical details. So if it achieves that end, I'm very happy.
The subtitle of your book is Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. Let's take this one at a time. What is reality?
Tough question. So reality is a concept which I think has been undergoing a great deal of change over the last 300 years. The intuitive notion of reality is you look out and you see the world around you. You see trees, you see buses, cars, people, and that is what you consider to be real. But the thing is, when we have examined what actually makes up a tree, what makes up a person, and when we examine the ingredients, we find that they're very unfamiliar. There are things that you wouldn't imagine in your mind's eye, things like atoms, which themselves are made up of even smaller particles. And when it gets to rock bottom, when you're studying something solid like a table, physics has revealed that a table is actually mostly empty space. So even though you think of a table as completely solid with no holes in it, when we examine it using the ideas of modern physics, we find that that just isn't the case. And that's just a very small example of how when we look at things through the lens of physics, things that we take for granted as being part of reality actually are not what they seem to be.
And so when you say the texture of reality. What are you speaking of? Are you saying that you're trying to bring the reader into this understanding that what we may encounter here right now and speaking with you, you know, in our studio, and there's a smooth kind of tabletop here that I'm rubbing my fingers over that is, you know, cool and looks solid, but you're saying that by the term texture of reality, you're letting me know that this texture even that I feel is not actually real in a certain sense?
That's exactly right. The hope is that this book allows you to kind of enter the universe, enter the world in a different way, and in that way really sort of take reality and put it between your fingers and feel its texture, understand its composition in a way that you just couldn't based upon your everyday senses. I mean, the way I like to look at it is this. We take in the world usually, as you say, by feeling something with our hands or by seeing
things
with our
eyes. Taste, hearing,
etc. Exactly. And those senses developed over millennia so that we could survive out there in the wilderness, in the jungle. And for that purpose, our senses do a very good job. We have survived, at least so far we have survived. But our senses, which develop for that purpose, survival, need not be very good at revealing the true nature of reality. And in fact, our senses are not very good at revealing the true nature of reality. We need to go further. We need to use our minds. We need to calculate. We need to use equations. We need to use mathematics. We need to use experiments. And what I try to do in this book is reveal the new picture of reality that emerges from that deeper study.
Now, you say the true nature of reality, and you speak about mathematics, and I want to get into that a bit, especially later. But when you say the true nature of reality, are you saying then that the spaciousness of a stone, a rock that to me feels heavy and solid, but that is mostly composed of empty space on the molecular or quantum level, are you saying that's more true than my sense of it?
I wouldn't say that it's more true, but I would say that you need to have both images in mind to really have the full depth of reality. In other words, if you only think of the stone as this heavy, solid mass in your hand, then you're missing a big part of the story. You're missing what's actually going on inside of the stone, and what goes on inside is very different from what you would see just by observing the surface of the stone. And again, the stone is just one example. Most of the examples in this book have to do with the nature of space and time. For instance, most of us think of time as being something that's universal. You know, time ticks off the same rate for me as it does for you, the same rate as it would on Mars and Andromeda Galaxy and so on. And that just is not true. What we've learned from physics, and we can discuss it in more detail later, is that time ticks off at different rates depending on how fast you move. It ticks off at different rates depending upon how strong the gravitational field within which you are immersed.
Now, you should be clear here, and I'm sure you mean to be, when you say different rates, you're not talking about what some people call psychological time. That is to say, I was scared, you know, the gangster pulled a gun on me and time slowed down.
Right, not that at all, even though that is an interesting effect that psychologists do study, so I don't want to denigrate that, but what we're talking about here is the rock-bottom nature of time itself. Not just the perception of time, as would be different based on different circumstances. We're really talking about if you have a watch and I have a watch and they're absolutely identical watches and they both function perfectly. If you were to go out into space really fast, near the speed of light, say.
In a spaceship, say.
Mm-hmm. Go out for 6 months and then turn around and come back for another 6 months. 1 year will have elapsed on your watch. You'd be 1 year older. Mm-hmm. But when you return to Earth, you will be shocked because you will find that 1 year has not elapsed on Earth. Instead, perhaps 10 years have elapsed, or 100 years, or maybe even 1,000,000 years will have elapsed depending on how fast you are moving. Because when you move quickly, your watch ticks off time at a slower rate. So even though 1 year has gone by for you, much more time has gone by for me sitting still here on Earth. That is totally unfamiliar. It's something that we never experience in day-to-day life simply because we never go quickly. We never go near the speed of light. But this is an element of reality which I think is important to understand because it affects something so critical to everything we do, time.
What is time?
Time, I think the best definition of it's a measure of change. So when things change, we know that time has elapsed, and time is that feature of the world that really allows change to occur. So in this example, 1 year will have gone by for you means your body will have changed. It will reflect 1 year of aging. but my body on Earth will reflect 10 years or 100 years of change, 100 years of aging.
When you say space, then what are you talking about?
Space I like to think of as the very arena of reality. Space, if you will, is the stage within which and upon which the events that define reality take place. And it was Newton himself who first thought about space. And his view of space was very, very intuitive. He says, space is just out there. It exists. It's unchanging. It's eternal. It's static. It just is. And that was the view that many people held until Albert Einstein came along in the early part of the century, the early part of the 20th century, I should say. And because not only did Einstein realize these bizarre features of time, the ones, in fact, that we have just been discussing, he also realized that space itself is not unchanging. Space can warp and curve. It can change its very shape. It's as if the stage of the universe is not solid. It's a stage, in fact, that responds. It's more like a trampoline. So space, in this malleable imagery that Einstein gave us, is a participant in the evolution of the cosmos because its very shape can change.
Now, this fact that the shape of space can change is directly related to Einstein's conception of gravity,
yes,
is it not? And
absolutely.
Our understanding of how gravity works and what it is.
That's right.
Could you explain that, please?
Sure. Again, Newton was the first person to try to think about gravity. And Newton actually wrote down a formula that tells you how the gravity of the sun, for instance, affects the Earth. And it's a good formula. It works really well. But he was unable to say what gravity actually is. Einstein filled in that gap because he found that what gravity is nothing but the warps and curves in space that I was just describing. Now, it's a tricky idea. Let me give you an analogy, which I think is very helpful. Imagine you have a trampoline, and it's nice and flat. And you take a little marble and you roll it along the surface of the trampoline. The marble will go in a nice straight trajectory. Very simple. But now let's say you take your little brother and have him stand on the trampoline. So the trampoline now is curved. If I now take that marble and I set it rolling along the surface of the trampoline, it won't go in a straight line any longer. It'll go in a kind of curved trajectory because it's rolling along this warped surface of the trampoline caused by your brother's presence. That imagery is what Einstein...
The actual dimple that he
put... The dimple that your brother created affects the motion of the marble.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Einstein wants to say this. He wants to say the sun actually warps space, much as your brother warps the trampoline. The sun creates a dimple in space itself. And the Earth, like the marble, won't go in a straight line because it's now moving in this warped environment. So when we go around the sun, when we go in orbit around the sun, Einstein wants us to think of that as the Earth is rolling along a valley in the curved environment, in the dimple created by the sun. And that is what gravity is. Gravity affects the motion of an object by warping space, and the object, when it traverses this warped space, goes in some unusual path that we attribute to the effects of gravity.
So again, to restate this, and maybe to say it a slightly different way, if I had a trampoline and the surface is really reflexive, that is to say, it'll really bend very naturally. It's not stiff at all, but it's strong. It won't break, but it's very soft in a way. And I put a bowling ball in the middle of it.
Yes.
And then I rolled a marble at it. If I do it just right, the marble will go around the bowling ball in a circle and keep doing that until it curves into the bowling ball and hits it and stops. You're saying that's what our Earth does around
the sun.
That's
what our Earth does. The only difference is that the marble rolls and hits the bowling ball because of friction. It has friction and it loses some energy, so it spirals inward. There isn't really any friction in space itself, so the Earth basically just keeps on going around and around and around. But the imagery is exactly right.
Okay. Then correspondingly, the idea of a black hole is like if you took that bowling ball or if you took a huge mountain and crushed it into a very, very tiny space, let's say the size of a marble, and put it on that trampoline. What it would do is it would be sucked down, if you will, into this magical trampoline that doesn't break. It'll be sucked down into it and form a funnel shape.
A funnel shape,
as it
exactly.
keeps falling, but doesn't break. And if we can imagine this in our mind, it's a trampoline, let's say, over an empty space. There's no ground underneath it. So this mountain in the size of a marble keeps falling until we can't see it anymore. And it makes this huge funnel-shaped dimple And that's what a black hole is?
Basically, that's right. So, and the key feature of a black hole, as you're saying, is a huge amount of mass crushed to a very small size. And the gravity is so strong, the funnel, if you will, is so severe that if you get too near the edge of the funnel, you fall in and you can never get out. So a black hole is something that if you get too close to it, you're doomed. You can't escape its powerful gravitational pull. And in fact, light itself is unable to escape the gravitational pull of a black hole, and that's why it's black, because light can't get out, so the absence of light is dark,
you
and that's why it's dark. Yeah.
Okay, here's a question now. Is the idea this, that space is a thing that when you inject mass into it, it has to get out of the way, and it's creating like room for it? Like the sun is actually, the reason space warps is because space is something that when you put a big object in, it has to like it's almost like if you had a crowded room and three people entered it. Three people who are already in the room at least would have to make some space so that those three people can fit. Is space kind of the same way?
That's a reasonable way of thinking about it. Sometimes when I try to describe the curvature of space, I use a metaphor that's very close to that, and it's one that was inspired by watching David Letterman's show when I was like in college. He would sometimes do a stunt where he'd have a big vat of Jell-O, and he'd ask somebody to dive into the vat of Jell-O. And indeed, when they dove into the vat of Jell-O, they kind of forced the Jell-O to curve around their body. They kind of displaced it, and that way created curved Jell-O. Similarly, when an object is in space, it kind of forces space to curve around it, sort of like the Jell-O curving around a body, and it's that displacement, if you will, that results in a curvature. The one problem with this metaphor, it makes it sound as though the curvature of space conforms to the shape of the object.
Exactly.
Where it's really more the mass of the object that matters. Because as you were saying, you take that mountain, you crush it to the size of a marble, it curves space incredibly. Even though it's really small, you'd think something small wouldn't curve space very much based on the metaphor that we're using. So it's really the mass, the amount of mass, that's more important as opposed to the shape itself.
We're speaking with Dr. Brian Green. Dr. Brian Green is a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. His new book is titled The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. His previous book, The Elegant Universe, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and both are excellent, very clear, colorfully written books about physics, but done for the common person so that you can virtually, I guess in a certain sense, have the kind of conversation that we're enjoying today when you read his texts. I have so many questions about this and about these ideas that you put forward, but I guess the primary question is, if the average person is not going to run into these phenomena, I know the phenomena you were talking about earlier where you set your watch with someone else's, you go near the speed of light and come back, you find that 1 year has passed, but on Earth, enormous amounts of time have passed. I think that's called time dilation.
Exactly.
In Einstein's theory. And if the average person is not going to experience this or going to actually realize that a rock, heavy as it is mostly empty space, why do we need to know this? Why does the average person need to, if we're never going to bump into this, like why do we need to know about it?
Well, I don't think that everybody does necessarily. For instance, I've encountered people, and you know, my mother is one good example, who don't care that much about these ideas and wonder why somebody like myself would spend all their time working and trying to figure this stuff
Mothers
out.
Mothers are good for that. For some
yeah,
reason.
That's right. Why aren't you a lawyer? you know, my own view is that, well, I guess my own view is captured well by a little story about a physicist named Richard Feynman, who was a Nobel Prize winner in physics. He died in the late 1980s. And he was once asked in an interview, you know, when you see a rose, does your knowledge of physics kind of kill all the beauty and wonder of the rose because you sort of see it in physical terms? And he said, absolutely not. It's quite the contrary. When I see a rose, I enjoy the beautiful red color just like everybody else. I enjoy the aroma just like everybody else. But in fact, I can go a little bit deeper than most people because I can look into the rose and see the molecular interactions that give rise to its color. And I can look into the rose and see the atomic interactions that give rise to its aroma. So these additional features, he was trying to say, enhance one's experience. If you don't have that additional knowledge, yeah, can you enjoy the rose? Certainly. But if you understand physics, you can enjoy it at an even deeper level. And I view that much more generally. I think that when you understand the world according to physics, you're able to enhance your life. You're able to enhance your experience because you can take in the world on a number of different levels. You can take it in on the everyday, as most of us do, but if you want to, you can go deeper in your mind and really see the inner workings of the cosmos. And I think for many people, that's both satisfying and exciting.
And beautiful.
And beautiful, absolutely.
Why is mathematics appropriate for describing the universe and its functions? Where does this usefulness fall apart and why? Could this usefulness be ultimately a matter of perspective? And could there be another language outside of mathematics that will ultimately do the job better, so to speak?
That's a hugely deep and important question. And just to tell you, I've often wondered about that question, but nobody ever asks me that question. So I'm really glad you did, because it really gives an opportunity to give a bit of an answer. So the most honest answer is I don't know why mathematics is so incredibly good at describing the world around us. Did it have to be that the world was described in the language of mathematics? I don't know. But we have experienced over the last few hundred years that for some reason, when you phrase phenomenon in terms of underlying mathematical equations, you get a lot of insight. You're able to make predictions about what will happen tomorrow. And when people go and do the experiments, they actually often see what you predicted would happen. And that tells us that we must be on the right track because we're able to do something with this mathematics. But, you know, were we to encounter an alien civilization like 100 or 500 years from now, and they may be much more advanced than we are, will they be describing the world using mathematics? I don't know. Will they be using our mathematics, or will they have come up with a whole other mathematical framework that does just as good a job as ours at describing the world, or even a better job? It's definitely possible. I don't know. Will, in fact, we find, as you suggest, that they're not using anything even remotely akin to mathematics? They've come up with a whole different framework that somehow reveals the universe in a more clear and more deep manner. I view that as a possibility. I think that we are very lucky that we have a language, mathematics, that is able to do as good a job as it currently does. Is it the final language for describing the truths of the universe? Is the book of the cosmos truly written in the language of mathematics? I don't know.
Are you able to, as a physicist, ever possibly get out of your mathematical mind to kind of wonder what that language might be or how? In other words, you say if we meet aliens, but what I'm specifically wondering about is I know that one of the issues of what's called unification, and you went at length about this in the series that you did for PBS, which was based on your book, The Elegant Universe, and was called The Elegant Universe, the three-part series that you did for PBS, you talk about the difficulty, and this has been going on for some time in science, in unifying quantum theory, which looks at how the universe acts at a very tiny level, the quantum level, smaller than atoms, and how the universe operates on the big level of galaxies and space as we see it, which is described by relativity. And what you say, and is what many scientists talk about it, this being an issue, is these two systems work very well, but it's a hard time getting them to match, actually, to actually join together and form one clean line, if you will, from the very small to the very large. And so what I've started to wonder, well, is there maybe a supra-language that makes this kind of unification very easy? And it seems that your idea is that, well, string theory is the, if you will, the description of the physical phenomena that actually makes this unification possible. But there's so many questions I'm asking you at once here. I guess the first question I'm asking is, as a physicist, to what degree are you able to say, let me not think in terms of mathematics?
It's, again, a great question. Often in our work, when we're still in the formative stage of building an idea, building a theory, the thought processes are often very visual. They can be drawings on a blackboard. They can be pictures in the mind's eye where one is trying to reconcile various phenomena in the world around us.
Einstein himself came to some of his conclusions by imagining himself riding a beam of light.
Exactly. So Einstein was the master of this, where he could, perhaps for hours, go into a realm of thought that most mortals like myself can only experience for a moment or two. And he can be out there, I think, you know, based on writings that I've read, where he would really just take in the universe in complete visual terms, sort it all out in pictures, and only later describe the visuals in the language of mathematics that made it rigorous and predictive. And that is definitely part of the research progress and process, I should say, of being a physicist.
And so much of it, reading what little bit of the history I've read, so many discoveries seem to come about by intuition
yes.
and gut feeling and things like that that ultimately are supported by math.
That's right. Oftentimes you're struggling, you're at a roadblock, you can't figure out where to turn in the research, and some imagery comes to mind and clears the roadblock visually. And then it's a matter of translating what you've seen in your mind into mathematics and see whether the details really support what your intuition made you recognize in your mind. And that's definitely a non-mathematical language, I would say, in which the progress is actually being made. We always, at least as of the 21st century, go back to mathematics as the bedrock foundation of how we formulate our physical theories. I'm suggesting that perhaps one day we won't go back to mathematics. Maybe we'll go back to some other language that has yet to be developed. But I should say, and perhaps most people don't realize this, when I talk about mathematics, I'm not just talking about the math that, say, the ancient Greeks wrote down or even people developed in the 1600s or 1700s. Today, when we do string theory, part of the progress of string theory is developing new mathematics that's particularly well-suited to describing the physical ideas that are emerging from this new approach.
Like what? When you say new mathematics, like what?
Well, for instance, we've developed a new kind of geometry. So most of us took geometry, say, in high school, in 10th grade, where we learned about the postulates of Euclid, you know, things that were developed a long time ago. When we go on in college to study geometry, I teach a course in so-called Riemannian geometry. This is geometry of curved surfaces using ideas developed in the 1800s. When we get to string theory, we find that the Euclidean geometry isn't good enough. We find that the Riemannian geometry isn't good enough either. We need to develop something that we call quantum geometry, a new kind of geometry that takes into account the physical phenomenon of quantum theory and string theory. And in this geometry, new things can happen. For instance, you were describing how when you put that really heavy marble onto the trampoline, it stretches the trampoline, but the trampoline doesn't break. That is the geometry of Riemann of the 1800s as exploited by Einstein in general relativity in the early part of the 20th century. We find in string theory that space can break. It can rip apart. This is something that you wouldn't anticipate based upon the geometry that was written down 100 years ago. But the physics of string theory, we discovered, allows space to rip apart and come back together, in that way requiring a new kind of geometry that can embrace these more exotic processes that even Einstein didn't consider.
Wow, fascinating. Are particles round? When I say particles, I mean atoms and electrons and protons. Are they round? And part of it is getting our minds out of what we've seen, the illustrations we've seen in science classes and stuff like that.
They don't actually have an unchanging shape. Their shape, if you will, depends largely upon their state of excitation, how much energy and how that energy is embodied within the object itself.
And part of the reason I ask is this. Part of the way I began to understand the idea that strings form quarks is I remember when I was growing up in the 70s seeing these 7-Up flicker lamps.
Yes.
And they were cans with the electric cord coming out of them and the bulb tied into the top, made out of a 7-Up can. And inside there'd be a filament that was flickering back and forth.
Yeah.
And the filament, of course, you know, is the glowing part of the lamp that's, you know, that gives the light. And what it essentially is a string or a loop, but the ends tied to the electrical part to provide the light. And I remember as this thing would flicker, because of its shape, it would form a spherical kind of image. Everywhere the light had been as it flickered, you actually see like a little ball of light. So I was wondering, well, when a string vibrates, is that how you get a quark, a little ball from? I don't know.
Essentially, that's right. So if you're talking about particles in sort of their most placid, their least energetic state, then we do envision that as being so-called spherically symmetric or roughly round. It would look the same irrespective of the angle of observation. And the way a string can create that kind of spherically symmetric configuration is very much like what you're describing in terms of the 7-Up can.
Flicker lamp.
So if you imagine the string certainly has dimension along its length, but if it's vibrating wildly, much like the flicker is vibrating from one configuration to another rather wildly, if it does that randomly, then there's going to be no special orientation.
It looked the same from any direction,
and on average it will therefore look like a ball, and that's roughly what happens in string theory.
Roughly. Very roughly, I'm sure.
Well, it's always...
I get the feeling you're being nice as well.
No, not at all. it's always hard to make use of everyday language, such as spherically symmetric or round, or even the notion of a string brings to mind, you know, just an ordinary chord in everyday life. All of these are metaphors which do capture some elements of the underlying physical theory, but the underlying physical theory requires ideas and concepts that we don't encounter in everyday life. So these everyday concepts are always not completely, perfectly describing what's going on in the theory, but I think they give us a good intuition.
From where does the vibrating string get its energy? This is the part I really don't understand. It's vibrating, presumably, as long as the universe exists. Where's the energy coming from to vibrate?
Good. I don't know, and nobody does. So the way I like to think of it is this. The deepest question in physics is, in fact, maybe the deepest question in philosophy is, why is there something rather than nothing?
So this is
a question that was asked hundreds of years ago by Leibniz, and it's a good one. Why is there a universe at all? Could it have been that there was really absolute nothingness, not emptiness, not empty space, truly absolute nothingness? Possible. But apparently there isn't. Apparently the world, the universe, does have stuff in it, and stuff has energy. Now, where that energy came from, there are suggestions, but nobody has any convincing answers. So I like to say...
In other words, like, why doesn't it get tired in a certain sense?
Well, once you have a certain amount of energy, we believe that there are conservation laws, that energy basically isn't created or destroyed. So once there is energy, it can change form. So you can get tired and slow down, but when you slow down, you're giving off heat to the environment. So your energy is just being dissipated. It's going someplace else. So I like to say, let's take it as a given that there is energy in the universe. And then strings, perhaps, are the most microscopic carriers of the energy that the universe contains. They are the fundamental currency. They are the pennies, if you will, of the currency of energy. They are the smallest unit of energy that the universe can make use of. But why are there pennies at all? Why is there energy at all? That's a question that we still haven't answered. But it is one that I hope, frankly, that one day we will. One day I hope we'll be able to say, here is why there is something rather than nothing. But what that answer will look like, I don't know.
Great. A few more questions, please. The Calabi-Yau, is that how it's pronounced?
That's right.
The Calabi-Yau shape, which is the six dimensions rolled up at the Planck level as such. And for those of our listeners, what we're talking about is there is a theory that our universe consists of three spatial dimensions, a time dimension, and possibly six very small dimensions at the ultra microscopic level. And one of the theories is that this shape, the shape of six dimensions, kind of looks like, the best way I could describe it is a very unusual flower, for lack of a better word. If you saw it, it's an incredible looking geometric shape, and you can see it in magazines and in certainly Dr. Green's books, on websites, etc. But the question I want to ask you is a Calabi-Yau, am I to understand that that's a flat surface in six dimensions?
Good question. It is a shape which is not quite flat in six dimensions, but it's as near to being flat and yet not being quite flat as a shape can be in six dimensions. Now, that may...
I love it. This is poetry.
It may be a sort of a confusing set of words, but when you study geometry, you learn that the word flat is itself a very complex notion because there are measures of how curved something can be.
Right.
There isn't just one number that says how curved something can be. There are a variety of numbers that we use to describe the curvature of an object. And a Calabi-Yau space is one in which many of those numbers are zero, which signifies flatness, but not all of them are zero. So it does have a certain minimal amount of curvature. And, you know, to my mind, I have to tell you, the idea of string theory, that our world may not just have the three space dimensions that we know about. Those are the obvious ones, you know, left, right, back, forth, and up, down. The fact that this theory demands that our world have additional spatial dimensions beyond the ones that we see, I find that so mind-blowing. And that's something which, you know, I've spent now 15 years thinking about these extra dimensions, trying to understand what physics they might give rise to and how we might perhaps observe these extra dimensions, maybe indirectly. And I think that's one of the most startling revolutions in our understanding of space-time that has emerged from the last 10 years of research.
And that is what, the ability to see this or to visualize it? Or?
Well, the fact that this theory claims that they're really there, number one, that's shocking. And number two, in the last few years, there has been a suggestion that within the next decade, we actually might be able to see them. There has been work in the last few years which suggests that these extra dimensions might not be quite as small as we once thought. They'd still be tiny, but they might be just big enough that in, for instance, the Atom Smasher that's now being built in Geneva, Switzerland, it'll be ready by 2007. And the hope is that
It's 54 miles in circumference?
Well, that was the one that was planned for Texas, Waxahachie, Texas. That was a superconducting supercollider. Unfortunately, the U.S. Congress, in all its wisdom, canceled that project. In fairness, it was a very expensive project. But
okay to wreck.
That's right, exactly. Okay. We could have done it in a tiny fraction.
Could have built two of those for the cost of it.
Two. Oh, more than two.
More
we
than
could
two.
Have probably built 20 of them.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's really unfortunate. But that was the 54-mile one. The one in Geneva is smaller. I don't remember the exact size, but it'll be pretty powerful. And the hope is that in very high energy collisions between protons that are going to be circling around this tunnel in opposite directions, they'll smash together. And the hope is that when they smash together, a certain amount of energy will be produced, and some of it may be able to seep off into the extra dimensions. And that's how we would indirectly recognize that the extra dimensions are real. We'd find that there's less energy at the end of the collision than we had at the beginning. And if the amount missing is of just the right quantity, it will give evidence that the energy has drifted away into these tiny extra dimensions. And man, if that experiment works, that'll be a fantastic moment in the history of our species. We'll have, for the first time, given evidence that there are more dimensions than we can see with the naked eye. That would be amazing.
We're speaking with Dr. Brian Greene. Dr. Brian Greene is author of the book, The Fabric of the Cosmos: Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. It's on Alfred A. Knopf Press. I just want to bring our listeners into this part of the conversation by describing the cover of Dr. Greene's book. And the cover of your book, The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality, is it's white, pretty much, with the words on the cover, and this kind of wispy shape, if you will, on the front. It looks like almost like a ribbon or a translucent, but it kind of looks like smoke as well, in a way, kind of. And then I look at the cover for your previous book, The Elegant Universe, which was black, and it has this kind of warped energy kind of field shape with shimmers of light coming off of it, almost looking like the Aurora Borealis or something. But you get the sense of fields of space, of energy. And then another author, whose book I just got through reading, Lee Smolin, a colleague of yours, Three Roads to Quantum Gravity. And on the cover, it's kind of purplish, and you see these spiked lines and these kind of ripple images. And now, what is this about? Why do these books on physics look this way in your thinking?
Well, it's very hard to find a visual representation of the highly abstract ideas that these books are discussing. And I think it's a real challenge to try to capture the heart of an abstract subject with one image. And oftentimes what we do is just try to fix on one element of the story and bring that to life visually. So for The Elegant Universe, we were really trying to bring to life the idea of curved space, but we wanted to give the sense of space. So for space, you need light, sort of. You need galaxies. And you want it to be immersed in a black void, which we often associate with the fabric of space. And that's kind of where that imagery comes from. The one on the fabric of the cosmos was really trying to give a sense of the diaphanous quality of space. You know, this tangible but intangible sense of space. Because we all sort of feel we know what space is because we are immersed within it. But we can't really see it. We can't really touch it. We can't really grasp it. We can't really smell it. So what is space? So that image was just trying to give a sense of the perplexing nature of space.
Space is wispy?
It's kind of wispy. It's sort of there but not there. It's kind of one of those things that you know it when you think about it, but when you try to look at it, it kind of vanishes. And that's what that image was trying to convey.
By what method or protocol do you work to popularize science?
Well,
what guides you as you do this?
What I try to do is the following. When I'm doing my own research, I'm often doing mathematics. But intuitively, I never feel like I really know what I'm doing. I feel like I don't really understand my own work until I can formulate an image in my mind, a visual image in my mind of what it is that I'm actually talking about mathematically. And when I come to write a popular book, what I do is I focus on those visual images that oftentimes I've developed to assist me in my own research, and I simply suppress the mathematics, or in this case, sort of move it to the endnotes where you don't ever have to look at it if you don't want to. And I just try to feed off of the imagery, turn the imagery into stories, into illustrations, into metaphors, and in that way basically get rid of the technical stuff that most people aren't that interested in and just focus on the core ideas that I myself find that I develop in order to understand my own research.
To what degree is working this way, not in the way that you bring these ideas forward, but actually popularizing science and becoming known for it, to what degree does this cost you in some way professionally? I remember hearing about Carl Sagan being looked down on by some of his colleagues because of the visibility he had as a scientist. And I don't know, maybe it was he also didn't publish a lot. Maybe he wasn't publishing any papers. But I was wondering, like, to what degree you worry that you might stop being taken seriously by colleagues because you become known as, you know, I'm not saying Bill Nye the science guy, but, like, you know, someone who's very visible and talks to the public about science.
Yeah, I certainly had that worry. In fact, much more with the television program as opposed to the books, because in the television program, I didn't have control over how the science was discussed. See, in my books, I really feel like I don't water it down. I don't dumb it down. The science is really there, and any of my colleagues who read my books recognize that I've really gone to great effort to try to convey the truth of what we're studying, to not turn it into a cartoon. But when you do television, you have producers who are really more in charge than you are, and their image of what the public can digest may be different from your own. Luckily, the producers on The Elegant Universe had a vision that was very similar to mine. So when the project was finished, I was very happy with it. But to sort of deflect the possibility of colleagues somehow not taking me seriously, I basically do these two things. One, I make the popularizations very, very close to the science. I try to keep the integrity of the science intact. And then also, I do keep my own research going because I wouldn't feel like I could describe the science from an insider's perspective if I wasn't actually in the thick of it myself. So hopefully through those two channels, you know, keeping my own work going and keeping the popularizations really tightly tied to the science, I won't suffer the fate that I have heard others have. But, you know, you never know. But, you know, ultimately you have to do what you think's important, and that's why I write these books.
You spoke about Richard Feynman and the rose and his appreciation of it being deepened by being a physicist. Why, in your impression, do so many physicists either reject or have difficulty with or not accept the idea of God?
Well, I can only really speak from my own personal perspective. And my view is that I don't reject the notion of God. My view is that we have to admit the possibility that God has set this all up for us. And he set up everything, or she has set up everything that we've discovered and is behind the scenes in everything that we're doing. And there's no way we can ever prove that wrong, because any experiment we do, the answer could be, well, God set it up to turn out that way, so you can't ever disprove that God's behind it all. My own feeling is that I admit that as a possibility. I see no evidence for it, but I admit it as a real possibility. On the other hand, I also admit the possibility that there is no God, that all we're doing is revealing the fundamental laws of the universe, and the laws are all there is nothing else. And frankly, whichever framework is true, I find that it's very exciting. In other words, if the research we're doing is revealing the handiwork of God, wow, what an honor, what a noble task to be involved in. If the work that we're doing is revealing those fundamental laws that brought the universe into existence and govern its evolution, wow, that's fantastic too. So from the point of view of the day-to-day work, the framework within which it fits doesn't really affect what I do, and I admit the possibility that maybe there is a God behind all this, even though I see no evidence for it.
You know, that's really interesting. And if I may, speaking for myself as a person of faith and attempting to be a Christian, my position is that for Christians who accept the Bible as their document of faith, there's just enough there for you to read it and become a pompous blowhard, or to become a really generous, soft, and caring person. And you can take it either way, and maybe that's the test. Maybe what it is actually is, yes, one can actually read the universe as godless or godful in a certain way. And that's actually what it is. Like, you can read it either way. The question then becomes, how do you read it? And I guess for myself, not being a physicist, just being a person who, you know, likes these questions and these issues and loves books like yours, when I read your book and when I read, you know, these ideas, I see infinite design, infinite levels of it, and complexity and a range and, you know, to cite the title of your last book, elegance. And so I'm not here or interested in converting anyone or anyone believing what I believe. I just wonder, what do physicists see when they have such a particulate knowledge of how the universe works? And it's so precise and so futuristic. And when I say futuristic, I mean in the sense that from what you know now, you can make guesses or estimates as to what will occur. So I'm just wondering how, with all of that around one, how one sees it.
Well, I think many of us are overwhelmed in the sciences by the depth of organization that we see in the world, by the depth of beauty and structure that we see in the world, as you say, by the sheer elegance of the way the world is put together. Now, to some people, especially those who have a very abstract notion of God, the organization, the beauty, the elegance is God. That is what God is. And from that point of view, perhaps the science and the religion really come together very, very directly. For people who have a more conventional notion of God as some being, be it some being with a white beard or something, I don't know, floating up in heaven, it's harder for us to see that very specific imagery of religion of God in the physics that we study. We don't see any evidence for that at all. But if you're willing to talk about religion at a very abstract level, in terms of the beauty, the elegance, the order, the harmony of the world and the universe, then yeah, that's what we find in physics. And that is what at rock bottom is what keeps us going, revealing that order.
And that's what you mean by elegance.
Yes, exactly. The fact that the world is put together in such an economical, in such a powerful way that we can come up with a few ideas that perhaps describe everything in the universe, even though the universe is so rich and complex, it may all be reducible to a few fundamental ideas. That is elegance.
We've been speaking with Dr. Brian Greene. Dr. Greene is a professor of physics and mathematics here in New York City at Columbia University. His new and latest book is entitled The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. Dr. Greene, this has been a rare and wonderful privilege. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that'll do it for this edition of Nonfiction. We want to thank our guest, Brian Greene, for his time, ideas, and insights. Nonfiction is a co-production of the Arts Department at WBAI, Janet Coleman, Interim Director, and of Media Assassin. Our engineer is Michael G. Haskins. Additional production was provided by Jeff Snyder, Grand Mixer DXT, and Harry Allen. Special thanks to Zakia D. McGregor, Kiko Nosferatu, but most of all, to you, our members, listeners, and supporters, without whom 99.5 would sound like this. Clearly bait for the evil Clear Channel Corporation. Please continue to support WBAI with your donations and gifts. Up next, Earl Caldwell and the Caldwell Chronicle. For Nonfiction, I'm your host, Harry Allen, wishing you an excellent and blessed week.